the Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to.
Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your host is equally humbled and grateful to the individuals who support our program through subscriptions like Cynthia Clark, Nancy Mrazek, John Dickerson, and Bonnie Baker. You can do it too. Just go to the homepage at peterbcollins.com and follow the links on the left-hand side under my picture. And we are still offering to people who sign up for a new annual subscription a copy of the powerful book by Sybelle Edmonds called Classified Woman. In the second portion of our podcast today, we're going to connect up with Kevin Gostola, a young journalist and blogger who has been covering the Bradley Manning trial at Fort Meade, Maryland. Some fascinating developments in that saga just this week.
It is useless to resist us.
But first, an update on our declining constitutional rights and the chipping away, in particular, at the Fourth Amendment. Shahid Buttar, the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, returns to our program today. And it's just been a few days since the Supreme Court issued a critical decision and a major setback for those of us who care about the Fourth Amendment in their 5-4 decision related to Clapper versus Amnesty International. Shahid, thanks for all you do, and thanks for being available today.
You're very kind. Thanks for having me on your show, Peter.
So this is, to me, a very critical case because with the expanded power of the executive branch, with the passive acquiescence of the legislative branch, and with the collusion now of the judicial branch, any effort to sue to overturn the dragnet rules in the FISA Reform Act of 2008, which was just renewed with zero amendments for 5 more years at the end of 2012, is very difficult to imagine. And this revolves around the issues of whether or not those people who have been wiretapped, which appears to be virtually every American, can actually prove that and cut through the veil of secrecy in order to meet the requirements of the Supreme Court related to so-called standing, the legal concept of having a basis to sue from. Shahid, what is your take on this Supreme Court decision and what it really means?
The Clapper versus Amnesty decision is a judicial travesty for lots of reasons, not the least of which is it effectively places the National Security Agency above the law. And if you think about the implications of the case for others outside the context of NSA surveillance, it also closes the courthouse doors on essentially anyone who alleges government violations that are hidden by that veil of secrecy that you described. You could think of it in that arena as sort of an extension of the state secrets privilege under a different judicial doctrine, but serving the same purpose of insulating the executive branch from effective and meaningful judicial review.
And in practical terms, it means that since the FISA reform of 2008 granted immunity to the phone companies who enable the government's massive surveillance of its citizens in the country, and this, to me, is a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's not ambiguous. It's not subject to multiple interpretations like the Second Amendment. And so we really have not only slammed the door, but put big bars and padlocks on it in terms of any meaningful review of this deep incursion on our Bill of Rights.
I think that's exactly right, and it's important to think about what that means. The founders of our country, for all their faults, envisioned a system where different divided powers would check and balance each other. And we see in the Clapper decision the Supreme Court affirmatively failing to exercise a meaningful check. And you might say, well, what about Congress? Of course, Congress just 2 months ago enacted before President Obama signed into law an extension of the 2008 FISA reforms to lock them in place for the next 5 years through the rest of the Obama administration into whomever takes office next. And so with Congress having essentially backed up the executive branch, the court throwing its hands in the air, the NSA, again, you know, the most secret part of the intelligence apparatus, the only government agency, as far as I know, to have burned $1 billion just in construction costs to build a single building, and the agency that's basically tapped the phone system and the Internet, there is nothing that an American can do in a court of law to check it. And I do think that that has very vital implications for the question as to whether or not we are free. And there are lots of other reasons we might not think we're free, namely that our government claims the authority to assassinate us without trial if we go abroad and say something that the government doesn't like. But just to think about the legitimacy of our system of checks and balances is eroding. And I think the Clapper decision, beyond the case and beyond the implications for judicial review, stands as a signal of our republic crumbling.
And Samuel Alito, writing for the conservative majority, said that the journalists and lawyers and human rights advocates who challenged the constitutionality couldn't prove that they had been harmed by it, and so they lacked standing to sue. And when they presented information about how they had changed their behaviors, for example, traveling to meet people instead of talking to them over the phone, and these are legitimate sources and contacts who could be construed in some way connected to terrorism. And in reaction to that argument, Alito wrote, "They cannot manufacture standing by incurring costs in anticipation of non-imminent harms." And so here the court operates saying, what's your problem? You know, you can't prove that you were wiretapped or that you were harmed in any way. And you really should just trust us, because if you've got nothing to hide, then you have nothing to worry about. And I find this deeply insulting and specious in any objective analysis of it. And Shahid, we saw, and I don't want to mingle the issues to confuse our listeners, but we're going to talk in a few minutes about reaction to the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, which has been challenged in court. And the most important piece of that for me is that Judge Catherine Forrest found that the plaintiffs in that case had standing even before the law went into effect, that she could see clearly how journalist Chris Hedges, if he made a phone call to someone related to Hezbollah, Hamas, or Al-Qaeda in pursuit of his work as a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, that clearly he would at minimum be inhibited by the terms of the NDAA and at maximum could be subject to its extreme detention language. So likewise, it seems very clear to me that journalists and activists and others clearly qualify for standing even in advance of any proof that they were wiretapped and that those wiretaps might be used in some way against them. But this conservative pro-government court has ignored those clear issues in order to slam the door shut and seal the effective block of any constitutional challenge to the surveillance program.
You're absolutely right. And the only place I guess I differ with you is in describing the justices in the majority of this decision as conservative, because conservatism implies the conservation of something that came before. This decision is radical. And while Alito and Scalia and Thomas and Roberts and Kennedy enjoy this reputation of being conservative. I mean, we should make no mistake. This is radical jurisprudence that upends centuries, quite frankly, of established common law. And that's not conservative at all. I mean, they might be politically conservative, but they are quite not conservative, quite radical in using their judicial office to, in this case, affirmatively insulate the executive branch from challenges. And there are a couple of reasons that might explain that, not the least of which is most of them served in the executive branch. And it's interesting if you contrast the contemporary membership of the Supreme Court with the Federalist number 78, where there was a whole discourse at the founding about the need for judicial independence, and it is judicial independence that is eroding, you know, something beyond a discrete doctrine, something beyond a discrete case. The institution of the judiciary, I think, is encountering a crisis, and to some extent it's longstanding, right? I mean, you can see the crisis in judicial legitimacy when you contrast, on the one hand, mass incarceration, 2.5 million Americans in prison, you know, far and away the most of any country in the world, while senior officials complicit in torture are not only running around free and holding positions of public prestige, but, you know, one of them is an appellate judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. You have torturers on the bench and millions of people locked up for nonviolent offenses. The illegitimacy of the courts is apparent if you look at it through that lens. The Clapper decision, you don't even have to be that creative. You just have to read the whole case. And the dissent is so obvious when you read the dissent how little water the majority's argument holds. And it's basically a catch-22. If the government decides to do something in secret, then the people impacted by it can't prove it. And if they can't prove it, the courts are going to say there's nothing to see here and move along. And that's, of course, preposterous. The reason courts exist is to check executive abuses. And here the Supreme Court is saying, we're not even going to let you, the plaintiffs, and we should be clear, these are people who have every reason to think they're being surveilled. I mean, these aren't just journalists and activists. These are journalists who talk to Hezbollah and Hamas. These are lawyers for Guantanamo Bay detainees. These are the quintessential, the usual suspects, exactly who the government would be targeting. These are the people they'd want to be targeting, quite frankly. And the idea that they don't have standing because they can't get the government document to prove that their communications are intercepted, it just sets an insurmountable hurdle. And it ensures, at the very least, that this program will stay out of the courts. And this is a program, mind you, that is siphoning at least dozens of billions of dollars off the top of a federal budget that is supposedly in crisis to conduct plainly illegal and unconstitutional surveillance of law-abiding Americans. So it's offensive in at least two different dimensions. A third, you know, budget, constitutional violations. A third, if you think about how it's been placed above the law by the courts. And I do think it's really disturbing to think about its implications. One part, this is a little in the weeds, but you made me think of it when you read a quote from Alito's opinion about imminence. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to contrast the nature of imminence as described by Justice Alito in the Clapper case on the one hand with, on the other hand, the way the Office of Legal Counsel memos authorizing extrajudicial assassination through drone strikes have been interpreted. And in that context, imminence means, you know, you just have to be a male in the right part of the world. That's what imminence means in terms of imminent harm. You know, any male in Yemen, any male in northwest Pakistan is possibly a suspect. It doesn't matter what they've done. It doesn't matter who they know. You're a suspect. You're a target. It's imminent. And now you have, going before the Supreme Court, people alleging a much more imminent harm than that presented by these people, right, who are routinely vaporized. Mm-hmm. And the court's going to say to these journalists who are, you know, interacting with these very people, you don't have an imminent threat of surveillance by the NSA, even though the architects of the program have already said in public that the security agency has tapped the entire phone system in the back end of the Internet. And under their allegations, which no one, you know, in the government has ever disproven, the government is watching all of us all the time.
Well, and Shahid, we know that at the NSA there was this this bullshit program. That's the best way I can describe it. Nice. Where they claimed that they were, in order to protect journalists, they were putting them on a special list and saying, well, don't wiretap these people. And it becomes clear when you look at the available evidence that James Risen and Eric Lichtblau at the New York Times, who were covering the NSA, were indeed wiretapped, and that those wiretaps were used to attempt to bring James Risen in on a legal case where they had a prosecution underway. And so, you know, we cannot trust the assurances of the government that they only use this to get bad guys. And you're very correct that these widening interpretations of critical terms like imminence to the point of meaninglessness really gives them the blank check to do whatever they want. And we might hope to find remedies after the fact. But as Catherine Forrest, the judge in the NDAA case, pointed out, habeas corpus in the situation where one is being held indefinitely without charge or trial, that's a remedy that takes a very long time to effectuate. And so the incredible power that has shifted to the government, which was pretty powerful to begin with, is stunning in my view. And the passivity of most Americans in watching our critical constitutional rights be eroded before our very eyes, as we're told to look over there at this enemy, this murky enemy overseas that we're supposed to believe is the threat. Well, no, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda have done nothing to limit our constitutional rights. That has been done by elected leaders and appointed judges, who those judges have been activists in ways that they often deplore and say, oh, the damn activist judges, you know, we're strict constructionists here. But the actions of the Roberts Supreme Court have hardly been restrained, which is the way they like to describe rulings like this.
I could not agree more, and it's interesting to think about the words of FDR at a time like this, that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, and it is fear itself that is driving our elected leaders and our co-opted judges to adopt these kinds of very authoritarian measures. And if you look at the war on terror through the lens of whether or not liberty in America will survive, through that lens, we are losing it. Even if we've won militarily the struggle against Al-Qaeda, you know, another way to look at this is that the contemporary terror threat, to the extent you've, you know, located in Central Asia, it was the CIA promoting it in the 1970s. So, I mean, at the end of the day, we're basically more concerned about a CYA for the CIA than we are about our own constitutional rights. And I think that one of the challenges that presents we the people is what to actually do about it, right? I mean, there are all the barriers of ignorance and apathy and helping people expose or gain access to the information that's out there that they might not see very readily, which is one reason why I so value your program and the work that you do. And beyond that, I think one of the challenges is to help people grapple with and identify what they as individuals can do. And I meet so many people who recognize what is happening but don't know what to do about it. And that, in particular, is where the work that we do at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee comes in. And as dark as these issues are and the national macrocosm, I do want to leave your listeners with some reasons for hope. And there are many springing forth, you know, from coast to coast and all points in between.
Well, I understand that. At the same time, once these rights are taken away or given up, it is very difficult to reclaim them. And so, you know, I want to be positive and activist and all those things, but I'm in a state of mourning, frankly, because I've been following these cases for many years now. The case that came out of Detroit, Judge Anna Diggs Taylor ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, but they were found not to have standing by the appeals court. And likewise, the case that we gave a great deal of attention to here that came out of a San Francisco lawsuit, Al-Haramain versus the government, where, in fact, they were able to show proof that they were wiretapped. They were conferred standing by the trial court judge. But then using these what I call judicial sleight of hand at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, where you didn't mention his name, but Jay Bybee from the Bush Office of Legal Counsel, who authored some of the torture memos, along with John Yoo. This alleged liberal court ruled against the Al-Haramain case, and then attorney John Eisenberg chose not to appeal it for some pretty good reasons. But it pains me that no one will likely find standing, given this Clapper decision, in the foreseeable future.
That's right, and you can see in this the reflection of different modes of judicial interpretation. There's a formalism that pervades the Roberts Court's jurisprudence, and you can see it on display in this case, where the attachment to this notion of standing, which we should, it's worth noting, it was a judicial contrivance in the first instance. Standing is a doctrine that judges invented to keep cases out of their courts that had, essentially, the prototypical case that loses standing is one in which someone's trying to assert a right that hasn't impacted them, has not impacted them. But the fact of the matter is, in this case, the plaintiffs have been impacted, right? And if you think about the way in which the decision by the majority turns a blind eye to the facts on the ground, specifically that last one you said, that if you don't see standing here, you will never find it anywhere, which will place the agency conducting this activity effectively above the law, it turned a deaf ear to that. And the justices in authority, the four moderates on the court, Breyer, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan, they saw that, right? They took notice of the actual facts, and that realism, that legal realism, is a functional approach to jurisprudence that has fallen out of favor. And so we really have a tension here between functional jurisprudence and formalist jurisprudence, and you could roughly map that jurisprudence in the functional context that looks at the facts and the reality, the realism, and then on the other hand, the formalism being this very academic, ideologically infused approach to judging, which is the kind of jurisprudence that's happening under the leadership of Chief Justice John Roberts.
Very well put. And let me quote here from Friday, actually it's a couple of days ago, February 26th, the New York Times editorial in reaction to the Clapper decision. They write, Justice Samuel Alito, writing the 5-4 majority opinion, misleadingly presented the court as a model of restraint and its ruling as a narrow one. But in fact, the decision will likely shut down all judicial review of this pernicious surveillance law, barring anyone from ever challenging its constitutionality in federal court. The majority ruled that the plaintiffs did not have standing to sue because they cannot show they've been harmed by the surveillance law. This is a classic catch-22. Since the surveillance is secret, and no one can say for certain that their calls, emails, and other communications have been or will be monitored, by the court's logic, no one will ever be able to show standing to bring a lawsuit. The court's decision is a clear-cut abdication of its fundamental role in the American constitutional system of checks and balances, which ensures that Congress and the President are not infringing on protected rights. And, you know, I regard the Times as a relatively conservative tower of expression. I know from the far right it's derided as liberal, but I consider this to be very common sense and not partisan. It's just a clear reading of the loss of our constitutional rights and the role of the court in facilitating that loss.
I cannot agree with you more. It's interesting to look at the position of political conservatives who have generally favored the jurisprudence of the five justices in the majority, but they're as incensed by the Clapper ruling as progressives are, right? Privacy is as much, even more in some respects, a conservative value than a liberal or progressive one. And so while this does reflect I share your assessment of the Times as, you know, in the grand scheme of things, a conservative institution, and the idea that the criticism from a paper that is derided as a left-wing rag by the conservatives would so clearly express the concern of political conservatives, mm-hmm. that the supposed conservatives on the bench have disregarded. I mean, it's just a very interesting contrast to see the supposedly conservative justices adopt so radically, so jurisprudentially radical an opinion.
Now, I want to move a little deeper into what you referred to a few minutes ago about the Office of Legal Counsel opinion that was written after the targeted killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen in the nation of Yemen, and his 16-year-old son, Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, was killed in a separate drone strike about a week later. And the killing of the younger al-Awlaki rarely gets mentioned in the public discourse, much less in the Senate intelligence hearings around the confirmation of John Brennan as CIA director. But we have this bizarre situation now where a 16-page abstract of the longer legal opinion from the OLC was leaked to NBC News. And then, interestingly enough, my colleague and you know Jason Leopold at truthout.org, 4 days later, he received an authorized copy of that 16-page white paper in response to a Freedom of Information Act request he had filed about 6 months ago. So we have that document, which is now public, but the more in-depth memo is being withheld, even from staff members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. They've allowed certain senators on Intel to see it, but not to possess it. And now this is even further complicated, Shahid, by the political maneuvering of the Obama team in an effort to get John Brennan confirmed. And as I put it in a recent podcast, they are willing to trade information about Benghazi for the confirmation votes for John Brennan. But in doing so, they are blocking the requests from Ron Wyden, Tom Udall, and even from Chair Dianne Feinstein that the Intelligence Committee should see these memos. And not one of those senators has suggested that they object to the underlying policy that is described in those memos. They just think that they're entitled to see them. And despite that very friendly approach from the Democrats on the Intelligence Committee, the Obama White House is snubbing them and is willing to serve up some information that'll probably embarrass them about the Benghazi raid in exchange for a shutdown of the minimal effort at checking and balancing that has been attempted by the Senate Intelligence Committee. This is so infuriating.
It absolutely is. I mean, I planned to get arrested in Brennan's confirmation hearing a couple weeks ago and wasn't able to in the end because you're a senator from California. Senator Dianne Feinstein kicked the entire public out of the hearing after there was so much protest about Brennan at its outset. And yes, it is absolutely appalling. And there's a bunch of issues with Brennan's nomination. I think you've struck on several of them. Just to add a few, you know, this was someone who served in the CIA for 25 years. He was in a senior position during the torture saga under the Bush administration. He was a senior leader of the CIA at a time when it was torturing people. He has never explained his actions at the time. He has claimed in the abstract to have resisted torture. I would love to understand what that looked like and how he actually complied with the legal obligation to report illegal and constitutional activity. He did not do that. That has barely even figured into the hearings since his hearing a few weeks ago. On the OLC memos, when's the last time that the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice was withholding memos from Congress despite repeated inquiries from across the political spectrum? I imagine you remember this.
Oh, I sure do.
And one of the authors of those opinions is now Jay Bybee on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. This was the same torture era,
right,
when the Bush administration hid the ball from Congress and refused to disclose documents that it has a legal obligation to disclose. I mean, Congress has the right to see these materials. There's no question there. And I think you're right that beyond the right to see the memos, let's just be frank here. The memo that was leaked to Isikoff, that first of the OLC memos, it lays out a supposed process, limiting principles that are supposed to constrain the use of the authority to kill Americans without trial. Well, from what we know on the publicly available facts, it is worth the paper it's printed on, if that, because those rules weren't followed. The example of the 16-year-old Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, born in Denver, you know, has a Facebook profile, likes soccer. No one ever alleged that he was even a member of al-Qaeda, let alone an operational or senior leader. of the sort that under the text of the memo one would have to be at risk of assassination through its authority. So you have the government, the Obama administration, hiding legal analyses, even though the one that has leaked doesn't actually support what little we know about the way these strikes have actually taken place. You have members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. I think it's absolutely important to highlight Ron Wyden from Oregon as, you know, the leading light on these issues. But also on the other side of the fence, conservative senators too, Rand Paul, has said that he would hold Brennan's nomination. And I think it's absolutely, Brennan should not be confirmed. There's no question that John Brennan is unfit to lead the CIA. And there's this notion in Washington that he's supposedly the best we're going to get. And that is just ridiculous, quite frankly. And it reflects the constrained approach to governance that the Obama administration is taking. He might be the only available 25-year veteran with torture on his hands and the architecture of a whole new genre of constitutional abuses, the likes of which even Dick Cheney never dreamed of. I hardly think that makes him the best candidate to lead the agency centrally responsible for creating the terror threat that our nation presently faces. I mean, it is preposterous, quite frankly, what the CIA has been able to get away with over the course of the last generation, and the idea that there should not be a top-to-bottom house cleaning there is preposterous. I do fear that we are going to end up landing, you know, some decades in the future in the middle of some other civilizational mess that the CIA will create. And if John Brennan is confirmed, you know, you can look at this point in history as a moment when an opportunity for accountability was resigned. And I do hope that his nomination is rejected.
And Shahid, I want to put this in some sort of a framework of the relative moral degradation. And let me cite Michael Hayden, who came out of the NSA to become the top spook under the new structure with the National Director of Intelligence. And he, after he left office, and after the drone strike that had killed Anwar al-Awlaki, said, geez, I needed a warrant to wiretap this guy, to monitor his actions and his communications and movements. But they didn't need anything to kill him. And while I am not in any way trying to rationalize or minimize the wrongdoing that occurred under Bush and Cheney, there were people who were tortured, and I, you know, strongly reject that as an American. But Obama isn't torturing people, we're told. He's just killing them. And 4,700 people, by the acknowledgement of our government, have died from drone strikes. We know that they weren't all militants. And rather than get bogged down in any, you know, attempt to sort that out, let's just assume that a lot of those people are innocent civilians, and no process.
Even if you assume that few of them are innocent civilians, that's still a problem, right?
Yeah, yeah. But when it comes down to the rights of the three Americans who were killed in Yemen, most people accept the conventional wisdom, which is an unproved set of allegations, that Anwar al-Awlaki was somehow the operational leader of al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula. And we do have, you know, clear cases where Abdulmutallab says he was inspired by al-Awlaki. Colonel Hassan, who is accused of the shooting spree at Fort Hood, says that he was inspired by Anwar al-Awlaki. Well, people get inspired by a lot of different things, but the sources of those inspiration are not treated as military or terrorist leaders and then summarily executed. And so we have this incredible creep from the torture policies, the wiretap policy enabled in part by the FISA myth, and now there is this suggestion that we should have a court just like FISA for targeted executions. And while some process would be better than the absolute lack of process we have today, I have zero confidence that an execution court would be any more credible than the FISA court is to wiretapping.
Absolutely. And it's so disturbing to see this proposal for a secret court welcomed by some people as a supposedly step forward. And to be perfectly fair, in the current regime, where the legal regime itself is secret, the operations are secret, no one knows anything going on, maybe it's a step forward from that, but it's such a profound concession. Think of it in these terms. A secret court, what defines courts? It's supposed to be consistency. That's what separates law from politics, is you identify a principle, and then you apply it in the same way across differing sets of facts. It's that consistency, the adherence to precedent, that makes law law. But when judges are issuing secret findings, when the decisions are secret, not just from the press and the public, but also from Congress, there are many examples of FISA court decisions that members of Congress have sought to no avail. You can't have consistency across multiple cases when the decisions in the prior cases are secret. It undermines the extent to which it is law in the first place. So secret courts aren't courts. I mean, we have to come up with some other word for them. A secret court is not a court at all. A secret court is a rubber stamp. And the idea that we would have secret courts to review extrajudicial assassination without trial is should be no comfort at all to anyone who values due process, their own life, or the opportunity to pursue happiness. I mean, what we're talking about here is a frontal attack on one of the core elements, not just of the U.S. Constitution, but I'm talking about the Magna Carta, right? I mean, the authority that the Obama administration is promoting literally rolls back the clock a millennium on fundamental rights. And that should disturb anyone, whether you're, you know, blue, red, green, purple. You know, these are issues that matter to all Americans. And I think it's also worth noting for, you know, to the extent you have any listeners who are supporters of the administration, the three-word question that might give them some pause is, who comes next? And do you want to have whatever person that is to have the powers of pervasive surveillance, arbitrary and indefinite military detention, assassination without trial? Maybe they can spy on you, they can detain you, torture you, or kill you. It's like the government has a pretty wide range of menu options now, and we as citizens have, unfortunately, fewer and fewer.
And Shahid, as we're discussing this, it brings to mind, I'm currently partway through a new book by an author named Jess Braven, and his book is called The Terror Courts. And the place I am in the book right now is a kind of detailed look at John Yoo and Jay Bybee's memos, not just about torture, but about John Yoo's extremely expansive view of presidential power. And to thumbnail it, he basically reduces it to the power of a king. And as I look at the signals that have been sent and the actions that have been taken by the Obama administration, and critically by the president himself, they're very consistent with that. This assertion of unbridled executive authority is really at the level that historically was attributed to royalty, not to any product of a democratic system.
I think you're absolutely right, and there's a dire need for Americans of all sorts to raise our voices to challenge this, because there's no one of the, and to go back to the Clapper decision, another thing we can take away from it is that the vindication for our rights will not come from official institutions. It won't come from Congress unless we push it. It won't come from the courts. And, you know, if the Obama administration is any indication, it's not going to come from the White House. I do find it particularly disturbing that President Obama could make it through the 2008 primaries by arguing for a fundamental reassessment of these liberty issues and the wars, and despite winning the 2008 presidential primaries on the strength of the peace and justice movement's backing, you know, he's now pioneering abuses that even Bush and Cheney never dreamed of, and the sheer breadth of the assault on our rights is particularly disturbing. But I would say that in that also lies an opportunity, because there are so many different kinds of people that are impacted by these abuses. There are so many different kinds of people who understand how these increasingly fundamental issues matter to the ability of our own children and grandchildren to live free lives, that I do have a great deal of hope that, you know, while the American frog is being boiled in the water of authoritarianism, we are not cooked yet.
And on that note, Let's shift to a discussion of the activism that is in part driven by you and your colleagues at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. On a recent podcast, we talked with Nadia Kayali, who is a part of BORDC and a fellow with the National Lawyers Guild. And she has been supporting activism in pushing back on the use of unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, by local law enforcement. And in that recent podcast, we discussed the efforts by the Alameda County Sheriff just across the bay from San Francisco to acquire a drone that really could only practically be used for surveillance. But also, you have been active in getting local resolutions stating opposition to the detention aspects of the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012. And this week, the last week of February, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors unanimously adopted a resolution which is the 18th city in the country to oppose the indefinite detention of Americans without charge or trial. So first, I want to commend you for taking on this effort. Tell me what you see as cities and other government bodies take positions in opposition to the federal law. Where will this lead, Shahid?
I think it will lead to an opportunity to actually check the national security state in a way that we haven't been able to yet. And I should say just at the outset, the real credit for the resolution in San Francisco really belongs to the folks on the ground, including Nadia, and you know, I think about the folks at the SF 99% Coalition, the San Francisco Labor Council, Code Pink. They were all involved, and those groups certainly deserve the lion's share of the credit for making this happen, as well as some of the elected leaders in San Francisco. The president of the Board of Supervisors, David Chu, championed this resolution and spoke about the need for it very assertively, specifically linking the contemporary NDAA and the threat of military detention within the United States to the very unfortunate, tragic history of military detention of Japanese Americans during the Second World War. And that history of military detention makes this an issue that is particularly predictable. You know, we have been down this road before as a society, not even, quite frankly, that long ago, less than a century. And the need to remember that history, invoke it, and allow our own present and future to be informed by it is dire. And that's one of the reasons that I think these kinds of resolutions are so important. Another couple things that will go toward that question you asked, what comes next? It's interesting to see how many different states are moving. Just last week, Montana's State House passed an anti-NDAA resolution. State of Michigan at the end of last year had done the same. There were hearings also in the state of Maryland. There's a new bipartisan bill in Texas. So you see in states big and small, red and blue, all around the country, there are elected officials who are grappling with these issues. And here's what happens when city councils pass resolutions and when state legislatures take action. The first thing that happens is media exposure for those issues. Most people don't even know about the NDAA. They don't know what it means. Mm-hmm. They don't know why it matters to them.
Yeah.
And so those resolutions have a way of forcing the issue into the public. The second thing they do is make sure that elected office holders who maybe if without these coalitions pushing them would never hear about this issue and make sure that as they move along in their careers, they're aware of these concerns and they have a public position. You know, they have taken a position on due process before they go to the state legislature, before they go to Congress. It's about acquainting these people, the electeds, with issues. And at the state level, when we do ultimately find ourselves in Sacramento seeking from the California state legislature a resolution to oppose due process, it won't just be our allies at the San Francisco 99% Coalition and the Labor Council and Code Pink mm-hmm. who are going to Sacramento, it's also going to be elected leaders from the San Francisco Board of Supervisors who will be talking to their colleagues about why they took an affirmative action in their official capacities to restore rights that have been abused. So it changes the composition of the coalitions from being strictly grassroots to then including office holders. So you've got media, you've got acquainting young office holders with their these issues as they move along. It's engaging them now as change advocates. And the biggest issue, and I can tell you a quick case study from Maryland to demonstrate this, there was a city council resolution in Tacoma Park, Maryland, just outside of D.C. that passed about 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Maryland State House in Annapolis had a hearing last week about an anti-NDAA resolution in Maryland, that coalition was able to mobilize. And they took a bunch of people to Annapolis, and they shared their views. And even though the bill had been introduced by a state legislator who is not a member of the committee that had to hear it, the fact that a bunch of people showed up and spoke about it very forcefully has engaged legislators to take on the bill. And it create these local campaigns, create pockets of mobilizable resistance that remain even after the media cycles, even after the office holders move on. It's about reinvigorating networks of people who are poised to take action where they live. And that's what makes the local organizing that we do at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee so powerful. A lot of people ask me, well, what does it matter if a city council or a state legislature says it doesn't like this federal policy? Can't, for instance, the NSA wiretap us anyway? And the answer, you know, in the immediate term is yes, that's right. But over the long term, it's the only thing that matters. Clapper demonstrates that. We can sue the government all we want, but if the courts won't take the cases, if they're closing the courthouse doors, you know, that channel is shut down. So what do we do next? We have to shift our culture, and the only way to do that is from the ground up. And that's something that anyone can participate in, that anyone can help make happen. And we at the Bill of Rights Defense Committee are eager to work with any of your listeners who want to raise their voices to challenge these very disturbing issues that we're talking about.
Well, Shahid, one of the reasons I value you is you have a sense of optimism and organizing. You take the long view, and it helps lift me a little bit because, frankly, I find these, particularly the court decision this week, to be a source of depression. It bums me out. And I do agree that we can't stop resisting. We cannot stop being active about these issues, and hopefully over the long term, we will prevail and see a return to a sensible approach and to, you know, the clear confines of the Bill of Rights. And, you know, we need to continue to assert those rights, even in the face of efforts to chip away at them. Before I let you go, Shahid, I'm going to move on to a conversation with Kevin Gostola about Bradley Manning. And I wanted to know what your reaction is to his remarkable testimony to the decision to plead guilty to 10 counts of what are essentially misdemeanors and to stand and fight the extreme charges under the Espionage Act and the phony notion that they're going to try to create that Osama bin Laden was aided and abetted by the leaks that were caused by Bradley Manning.
The prosecution of Bradley Manning is, quite frankly, preposterous. And I think it may ultimately take the same trajectory as the prosecution of Thomas Drake. Thomas Drake was the senior NSA official who gave up his career to reveal to the public what was happening. Bradley Manning did the same. And in his testimony, he spoke about wanting to alert the world to abuses and allow a conversation to happen about whether or not our nation's military activities were legitimate. And he disclosed a great many things, some of which were sensitive, some of which were not. Many of them included evidence of crimes that had been suppressed. And that's an act to which military service members are committed. He did what he has to do under the Nuremberg rule, right? If you discover human rights violations, even if they are, you're ordered to commit them, you're supposed to resist, you're supposed to disobey those orders, and you're supposed to pursue accountability. He did that. He went up the chain of command and said, look, I found some really disturbing things. These are examples of people being turned over or flagged as threats when they simply were criticizing the regime in Iraq. And you know, his commanders wouldn't do anything about it. He went to the New York Times. They wouldn't take the story. He went to Politico. They wouldn't take the story. When he sent the documents that he did to WikiLeaks, it was really a matter of last resort. It was the only way he could comply with a legal duty. And the idea that he's now being prosecuted for it instead of the officials whose abuses are depicted in the materials that he disclosed. You know, why is it Bradley Manning standing trial instead of the people in the video of the helicopter who shot the journalist? right? Why aren't they on trial?
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't Judge Jay Bybee on trial instead of, you know, it's preposterous when our courts not only close the courthouse doors on these really important legal challenges, but then also allow these vindictive witch hunts where prosecutors go after people who've committed no crime, you know, but merely performed their public duties, just like Thomas Drake. And, you know, for anybody who didn't follow that story, the way it ended, I wouldn't describe it as a happy ending, but when he pled guilty to minor offenses, he appeared before a federal judge in Maryland who, at the sentencing hearing, had some very unkind words, not for Thomas Drake, but for the Justice Department for wasting so many taxpayer dollars and so many years chasing around this public servant who'd done nothing but try to meet his obligation under his oath of office to the American people. And I think that that's exactly what Private First Class Manning was doing. He is a hero. By the way, Kevin does great work, and I'm excited that he'll be on your program. And I do hope that as Bradley contends against the charges, the illegitimate charges that he is facing, that he is found innocent and vindicated in the court-martial.
Shahid Buttar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Visit their website and sign up and get active at bordc.org. Thank you, Shahid.
Thanks for having me on, Peter. Keep up the great work.
Kevin Gostola returns to our program today. As he pointed out in a blog post, February 28th was the day that Bradley Manning took a guilty plea on some charges and told his story to the court-martial panel. And February 28th is also the day that CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou reported to prison. Kevin Gostola blogs as The Dissenter at FireDogLake.com, and he joins us today. Are you still at Fort Meade, Maryland, Kevin?
Nope. I've managed to escape, and I'm not there anymore, although you never really leave Fort Meade.
Yeah, no, it follows you everywhere. You don't need to worry about that. So, Kevin, we reported yesterday in my news and comment blog about some of the remarkable proceedings and what we can now see as the strategy to defend Bradley Manning. His lawyer filed documents to plead guilty to 10 charges, and he freely admitted that he was, in fact, the source of leaked documents to WikiLeaks. But it sets the stage for what I think will be a strong battle against the more serious charges under the Espionage Act. And in a moment or two, I want to talk about what we now hear as a gambit to bring in a Navy SEAL to try to establish that there was harm caused by Bradley Manning's actions. But first, if you would, describe for our listeners the scene in the courtroom as Private First Class Manning spoke under oath and told his story about what motivated him to take these actions.
Yesterday, Bradley Manning sat at the table that he's been sitting at for every proceeding, and he didn't do it from the witness stand. He sat at this table, and he read a prepared statement. It was 35 pages long. He took about just a little over an hour to read the statement that he himself typed up in confinement at Fort Leavenworth. And what it was, essentially, was a background on how he wound up deciding that there were these sets of documents or videos that needed to be released so that the public could see them and those in the American public could have debates about foreign policy, counterinsurgency strategies, counterterrorism, what he was experiencing overseas. He found to be bothersome and problematic because it just didn't fit with what he thought was, I guess you could say, morally correct. And he thought that others back home should be able to have discussions about what he was seeing in his daily job as an intelligence analyst or maybe just as an Army analyst. And so what his statement was going through each of the charges that he was pleading guilty addressing the possession of the information and the willful communication of the information. And ultimately, he was pleading guilty to, as you say in the front of this segment, he was pleading guilty to the less severe charges.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, he's not pleading guilty to any of the major federal charges that the government is pursuing, such as aiding the enemy, which carries the potential of life in prison without parole. He didn't plead guilty to stealing the documents. The government says he stole the documents off of these databases. He didn't plead guilty to violating a federal larceny statute. He did not plead guilty to exceeding his authorized access on a computer. That's a crime that falls under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which has received a lot of attention recently because of Aaron Schwartz's suicide. And he was being pursued under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. And so you have these charges that they don't believe, the defense decided they want to fight those in a trial. But the other ones, they thought, well, let's get this out of the way, let's plead guilty, and then let's separate it, and maybe we create an extra burden for the prosecution. I'm not sure. That's their strategy. I don't know if it's worthwhile to spend too much time speculating on whether it's good or not. I personally find other aspects of the proceedings to be much more worthy of discussion.
Well, please continue then, because I really think that defense strategy will become clearer over time. And I agree with you, there isn't a lot of benefit in second guessing. I do see that in these other cases that were not in the military justice system, that the cases generally collapsed. But they wanted a pint of blood, or at least something, from the person that they had targeted as part of this whole process of, in my view, silencing whistleblowers. But go ahead and talk about the other elements that you thought deserve more attention.
Well, I'm fascinated by the fact that Manning said he wanted to provide the war logs to the Washington Post. In fact, he said that his preference would have been to have given the war logs to the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
And he called and got a woman on the other end. It sounds like it may have been a clerk or maybe a receptionist. And that person said something about generally it seems the woman was perhaps interested in seeing the information, but Manning would have to go to the post office in D.C. to show the material. And so that was where that ended. And then Bradley tried the New York Times, and he left a message on the public editor's line, I believe. And apparently they get like 80 to 100 messages per day. So what happens is, and this just goes to the dysfunction, I think, of the news organization, is they perhaps listen to only 10 seconds of this message, and then it was deleted, and they never got to perhaps what could have been the good part, the part where they figure out what Manning was trying to offer the New York Times. And so those failed, and there was a blizzard hitting D.C. He wanted to maybe go to the Politico office, the newspaper Politico, and try them. But he decided, I only have a little bit of time left. It was in January 2010. He's on what was mid-tour leave, and he would have to go back to Iraq because he wasn't done with his tour of duty. And so he said, I'm going to upload these documents to WikiLeaks.
Kevin, let's take a moment here to go a little deeper into this, because I agree with you that it's fascinating. My first reaction when I heard this was that corporate media outlets don't really accept news tips from either anonymous sources or just average citizens. And they have become so accustomed to having news packaged and fed to them by Hill & Knowlton, a PR firm, or a PR person for a member of Congress, or a PR person for a book author. And so there's a kind of peer-to-peer system that the stories don't get into the media unless you have somebody who is a peer of the journalist or the outlet that you're targeting. And anything that falls below that is pretty easily and blithely dismissed. And I think that's just a fascinating commentary on the way the corporatized and consolidated media in this country operates these days.
Right. I mean, even if we accept that the Washington Post or New York Times didn't do anything malicious to Bradley Manning, it still shows that the news media can't serve people who are lower level, who are maybe just average citizens who happen to actually have information. You and I know from following news sources that often there are what I'm going to call selective leaks from government employees in different agencies sending tips from within that will give people who claim to be journalists the ability to write a story that appears to be showing us what the national security state is up to at the current moment. And often it has an effect of serving some person's agenda in that organization rather than going deeper and getting to the core of what the programs are being used for by the government. And I think that it just shows how there is a need for leak organizations like WikiLeaks. Manning said when he was talking to the judge that he became nervous when he thought about how he was going to have to go to the Washington Post office. And I don't disagree with him. Mm-hmm. If I was in his position, I would have been nervous as well.
Well,
I know about the press.
And you're pointing out, Kevin, that Washington is a leaky town, and there are official leaks that are sanctioned. There are unofficial and unapproved leaks that occur. But if you want to leak something to David Sanger at the New York Times, you take him to lunch. And of course, you have to know him in order to get him to respond to an invitation like that. And so it creates a whole business in the media where it is by and for insiders. And here's Bradley Manning sitting on what both the Post and the Times have published as explosive and important information. But he couldn't get their attention because he didn't have standing, to use a term we were just discussing in the previous segment in a more legal context.
But here's something that everyone should consider. We should be happy he ultimately ended up with WikiLeaks, because we know that the Washington Post and the New York Times would not have published all of the war logs. We know that they would have grabbed 35 to 40 of the first incident reports they read that seemed to be somewhat interesting, and the rest would have gone in some dustbin, and we would have read probably a good story. It may have made some headlines in a day. And that would have been the end of it. And with WikiLeaks obtaining this information, you know, keep in mind, if the Post and New York Times had obtained these, WikiLeaks doesn't have them. So it's not like they can release them and show that the Post and New York Times have failed. So they wouldn't be able to do that as they were able to do with the state embassy cable. That's one thing to consider. The other thing to consider is, though I'm not too sure I have any evidence about what happened with the war logs and their coordination with the Pentagon, we do know that they were cooperating, that the New York Times particularly was informing the FBI, the CIA, these other organizations, the State Department, that they were planning on publishing cables. And they were selecting the ones that they were going to publish and informing them. And so I think if I'm Bradley Manning, I'm paranoid. I'm wondering what's going to happen. Is the government going to be connecting with the Washington Post or the New York Times if they even have the information? And am I going to be found out? Is my identity going to be revealed? And then it's not going to, you know, what I did is going to be, I'm going to be arrested for providing this information.
Kevin, next, I want to ask you, because I haven't had a chance to read Bradley Manning's 35-page statement yet, and I've read excerpts that have been cited in your blog posts and in other accounts. And one of the critical factors for me is the nature of the information released. And to put this into context, the President of the United States, in a really poorly thought out comment that he made at a fundraiser in San Francisco in 2011, made two big blunders. One was that he flatly said that Bradley Manning had broken the law. And that was before any proceedings, even these preliminary proceedings, had taken place. And secondly, he falsely characterized the information that Manning now takes credit for releasing as more sensitive than it truly is. And in a comparison between the Bradley Manning leaks and the Pentagon Papers that were leaked by Daniel Ellsberg, Obama falsely stated or incorrectly stated that Manning's information was top secret, and he inferred that that the Pentagon Papers were not. And it's important to note that Ellsberg released documents including top secret material, and to my knowledge, Bradley Manning is not accused of releasing anything that rose above the level of secret. And there's a very critical difference between those two bodies of classified content.
This is correct. And he had no access to top secret material. He made that clear yesterday when he was conversing with the judge.
Okay. And did he offer anything else in his statement to basically make that delineation?
And the basic fact is that he was in what is, I'll just call it a SCIF. It's a secure compartmented mm-hmm. intelligence facility, and this is where he worked every single day. And he was on the CIPR network, which is the secret intelligence, secret internet protocol, rather. I mean, I don't have to parse it out, but this basically was where all of these documents were being held that the different agencies can access, and he was using it to put together products for the military that were being used for operations. He was on detail to help with security for the Iraq elections. And so he had access to every single document that was ultimately provided to WikiLeaks.
Mm-hmm.
So none of this material was he going into the government databases and reading them and pulling them off. And he had no right to be in there. I mean, he was doing his job.
Mm-hmm.
And the possession did not actually become a crime. And when I use the word crime, I'm talking about what the government considers a crime.
Right.
Didn't become a crime until he had it on his personal computer and it had left the intelligence facility.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you get into what the government is pushing. I don't want to go too far into that. But the main element that needs to be focused on here is that none of the material contained troop movements, troop locations. There wasn't anything in this material that any single group, whether it be a militia that has been trying to attack the United States, whether it be a terrorist group that's been trying to attack the United States, nothing was in these war logs or nothing was in these state embassy cables that could have been used to say, okay, tomorrow we're going to go plant an IED here and we're going to blow up these people.
Mm-hmm. And that is very, very important, because in the manner that the government has treated Bradley Manning, with 1,000 days of incarceration, with the brutal detention methods that were used in his original imprisonment at Quantico, these create the impression for a lot of uninformed or ill-informed Americans that his leaks were really critical and that they did in some way harm the United States, its diplomats. And to date, we can find no evidence of anything other than the revolution in Tunisia and other things that occurred because of the State Department cables that were released. But there is no indication that what Bradley Manning is accused of doing led to any measurable damage to the United States, its diplomats, or military personnel. And this becomes critical because now we see in what I would regard as an evidence-free portion of the court-martial proceeding that the government is intending to bring in a member of SEAL Team 6 who will be testifying under a pseudonym and under ground rules that limit the defense's access to him before he testifies, and that he is going to try to make the case that in Abbottabad, when they raided the compound, that they found information derived from the WikiLeaks release in the possession of Osama bin Laden and reportedly or purportedly some correspondence where he was asking his field people to get him some or more of the WikiLeaks information. And I call this evidence-free because we're not, there's these layers of secrecy over so many of these aspects. We don't really know who the members of SEAL Team 6 are who conducted the raid. We don't really know if they actually captured and or killed and then captured the corpse of Osama bin Laden. We have to take that on faith because absolutely no evidence has been provided to prove that. And so we're going into an orbit here that I find bizarre and untethered, where the government is going to try to make the case that there was, in fact, damage because he aided and abetted an identified enemy of the United States.
So what I'll begin with is that I believe the main reason they're doing this is because you can get a lot out of a judge if you say terrorism in a courtroom. And they also know that they can say bin Laden in the courtroom, and that would have the same effect. And I think that's really what it is about, that connecting Manning's acts to Osama bin Laden is a loop that they never thought they would be able to make, but they claim to have obtained digital media that you and I haven't seen, that is shrouded in secrecy, that the defense has probably seen, but we don't really know what they've been able to look at. And they want to make this argument that the defense has outlined clearly in the past 2 days, even though I'm sure they didn't plan on doing this because it gives the prosecution an edge, they've been proving that the government doesn't have to show Osama bin Laden had these documents in order to prosecute the charge of aiding the enemy. Knowing that, one should realize how exploitive this is, that they are, one, asserting that the raid is still has all of these classified details, which I find to be ridiculous given the number of people who have published books, the fact that there was a Hollywood movie that was nominated for an Oscar called Zero Dark Thirty, and the filmmakers were cooperating with the CIA and the Department of Defense. And I just think that it's completely ridiculous that they can sit there and try to protect the person that they want to put on the stand who obtained this information that, by the way, declassified. It was declassified for the purpose of prosecuting Bradley Manning. I think people should just think about that for a little bit here, because what the government is really doing is trying to sensationalize the proceedings.
Well, and Kevin, I'm a fundamentalist about evidence, okay? And this is supposed to be a legal proceeding based on law and evidence. And the American people have received no evidence about what occurred in Abbottabad. There is information that was disseminated from official sources. John Brennan couldn't get the story straight in the first few days, but we put that aside. There is an official narrative, but they've provided no proof that it was actually bin Laden. And I suspect it probably was, okay? I'm not trying to spin whole cloth conspiracy theories here, but people have moved away from the fundamental process of saying, okay, you've told me something, now show me the proof. And that's why I referred to this as an evidence-free aspect of it, because we're told to take on faith, and the representation of Hollywood movies and a made-for-TV movie and a book that, again, all comes from official sources, that these have been independently verified. And while the average American thinks it's all true, it has not been independently verified, and it doesn't rise to the level of evidence that can be used in a trial that ultimately could deprive Bradley Manning of his life.
I mean, those are all incredibly relevant points, and I think, you know, the other thing that I'm trying to grapple with is the fact that I don't believe the military or government have protected the identities of these people they say were on this raid. I mean, we've had the ability to read little bits and pieces of everything. Some of them were even working with a video game creator to get the disclosing the tactics and what they were doing on the raid for a video game. So that doesn't show me that they're particularly concerned about keeping their identity protected. And so now in the middle of this major trial that is upcoming, there's going to be this person, this what they're calling a DOD operator, which is, you know, another way of saying was on the SEAL team operation. And the person who they're calling Mr. John Doe is going to sit on a stand in a closed session and talk about finding this information, and we're not going to get to see it, which I think is a complete sham, but I'm not surprised. And I think the reason that Bradley Manning read his statement and the contents of it is goes toward the fact that they realize that the military justice system has a great power and potential to prosecute. Where I think this case could collapse in a federal court, what I've witnessed is the military justice system has mechanisms in play that make it so hard for the defense to fight the government and have that happen. I think there are ways that the military prosecutors can manipulate in ways that the federal court would not allow.
And Kevin, you enumerate at least one of these in your blog post of March 1st regarding the back and forth between defense attorney David Coombs and the military prosecutor Major Ashton Fine. Bring that to life for our listeners a little bit, would you?
Oh, sure. So basically what was going on, I'm just going to orient people before I start to read from it, just to orient people that what they were discussing was whether they were going to go into a closed session and talk about how this person might testify. And so essentially what you're saying is this military prosecutor became extremely irate, and his name is Ashton Fine. And he interrupted Manning's defense lawyer, who is David Coombs, and basically said that the defense is trying to substantiate that a book by a citizen of the United States and a movie not made by the government means the government cannot protect information. And in response, Coombs said that was not his position. His position is they should outline what is still classified, and then that forms a boundary for what the defense cannot ask Mr. Doe about in a pretrial interview. Before Fine said, just because a book is written by an individual doesn't mean the government cannot protect him. And he was upset that the defense was making an argument that they could not rebut because they would have to discuss details that were sensitive or classified. So Coombs said, on that point, I think the President of the United States has acknowledged it. And the judge asked if the government's position was that the raid had not been acknowledged. And Fine said, the President did announce the raid had occurred, but who went on the raid is not necessarily public knowledge. However, I really question that because there have been depictions and representations of the people who have gone on this raid, and some of these people want to tell their stories, and so the government is, as they're so good at doing, exploiting their secrecy powers.
Well, and Kevin, a fellow I know, Phil Bronstein, the former editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, published a piece based on his interviews with a man he calls the shooter. And he claims that this is the SEAL who actually dispatched Osama bin Laden. And it's an interesting story, and he talks about how he doesn't have appropriate veterans benefits, can't find a job. You know, quite a bit of personal information. There's a replay of the raid and some of the aspects of that. And so here we have everything but the guy's name. But once again, we're told to take all this on faith because there's no evidence presented that Phil Bronstein, who is a reliable and credible journalist, and I don't doubt that he did interview a man who told him he was the shooter. And Bronstein says that he was able to independently verify that with other unnamed members of SEAL Team 6. But all of this, again, to not to belabor my point, but does not rise to the level of evidence. And that's the most critical part that I see as problematic, that they're going to use information, hearsay, and prejudicial testimony that, as I say, it does not rise to the level of evidence.
Yeah, and that's why the key that Coombs was bringing out in the court was we need to be able to have a pretrial interview with this witness. The government is trying to prevent the defense from talking to this person before he will take the stand in a trial. That is completely outrageous. And he was saying, we should be able to ask this person, where did you find this evidence? Did you get it in a trash can? Did you find it? Was it in maybe a bin that said, not important, and Al-Qaeda didn't really care about these WikiLeaks documents anymore? What happened? How did you find it? Is this person, do they have memory problems? Are they a habitual liar? Have they made statements to the press already? Well, if they made statements to the press already, we should be able to look at those statements and then maybe impeach him, perhaps, because maybe he's lying to the government now about what happened. So, this is key. But if we can, I would like to swing back just because I think your listeners really should be left with the thought of how Manning is a classic whistleblower, and perhaps, if possible, I would like to just read a couple statements that Manning had in court that went to the nature of the information he was disclosing. And what it shows is Manning fits the definition of a classic whistleblower.
Yes, he does. Go right ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, so just I'm gonna share a statement about the war logs and then just a quick statement from the collateral murder video, which is the Apache helicopter attack in 2007. So what he said about the war logs was that it, in great detail, it provided a context of what we were seeing on the ground. He said, quote, in attempting to conduct counterterrorism and counterinsurgency operations, we became obsessed with capturing and killing human targets on lists and not being suspicious of and avoiding cooperation with our host nation partners and ignoring the second and third order effects of accomplishing short-term goals and missions. I believe that the general public, especially the American public, if they had access to the information contained in the tables, it would spark a domestic debate on the role of the military and our foreign policy in general as it related to Iraq and Afghanistan. I also believe the detailed analysis of the data over a long period of time by different sectors of society might cause society to reevaluate the need or even the desire to even engage in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency operations that ignore the complex dynamics of the people living in the affected environment every day. And then so I'll read one quick thing about the collateral murder video.
All right.
And he said that one of the drivers of his concern was that Reuters, two of their employees are killed in the video.
Mm-hmm.
They were denied access to it under the Freedom of Information Act, and he was trying to get them an authentic copy of the video so they could have it, or they wanted to use it to see exactly how their people had been killed. And he said that the attack that happened involving the air weapons team was most alarming because of the bloodlust of the air weapons team. They dehumanized the individuals they were engaging. And he said he was struck by what the soldiers were saying in the audio. One individual is crawling on the ground. And instead of calling for medical attention, Manning said, the soldiers asked for the wounded person to pick up weapons so they could fire at the individual. He suggested that what he was witnessing here was like a child torturing an ant with a magnifying glass. The crew's, quote, lack of concern for human life and concern for injured children at the scene greatly bothered him. So I just think that's something to conclude with, because for the general public, a lot of them heard Manning just plead guilty to crimes.
Mm-hmm.
But we should really have a larger discussion about the fact that Manning's essentially just admitting he engaged in acts of whistleblowing. Those acts of whistleblowing are considered illegal in the military. And I think now, as a people, we have to confront the fact that this is something that the military doesn't allow, and decide if we're going to accept that Bradley Manning is going to serve any time in jail for really just researching documents he had regular access to and deciding that it didn't fit with what he was hearing public officials say to us, the citizens. And so we needed to see these. We needed to see that our government was being two-faced liars.
And Kevin, at least in the case, and I'm not saying this doesn't apply to other issues, but at least in the case of the video, what he did is classic whistleblowing. He reported what appears to be criminal acts by individuals under the color of uniform. And so I think that he made a strong case in his testimony, and I hope that more people will pay attention. Before we wrap up, I just want to ask for your comments on the other media coverage of the Manning case, because Charlie Savage of the New York Times gave a decent report on the public television news hour on Thursday evening about it, and the Times did a decent job of covering this. However, they waited 9 days to cover the preliminary hearings that occurred last December, and I want to note that I watched every minute of Rachel Maddow's program on MSNBC on Thursday night, and she did not find space to cover the Bradley Manning developments in any way. She spent 5 minutes promoting her appearance on Jon Stewart's Daily Show the same night and didn't find any room to report on what I think is a really critical case. So what are the hits and misses of the corporate media coverage that you have seen about this trial that you've been covering?
Well, just some context. You're talking about the hearing back in the end of November, first part of December. They were bringing all these people involved in keeping Manning in conditions that were cruel and inhuman at mm-hmm. Quantico Bridge. And I did a search through all of the news programming that was on CNN and Fox News and on MSNBC. I found one mention of Bradley Manning and discussion of his confinement. And I wonder if you can guess what show it would have been on.
Wouldn't have been Fox and Friends.
No, sorry, let me be specific. MSNBC. It was one show on MSNBC.
Up with Chris Hayes.
You've got it. The only program that provided any discussion or coverage of his confinement. And mm-hmm. then Fox News had more mentions of Bradley Manning than MSNBC for, you know, the wrong reasons. They were mostly it was mostly snarky. And CNN had, I think, you know, they had a number of mentions because they had a reporter who was covering the proceedings. And so in this case, this week, we started out with a low number of media interest, and when it was realized that Manning was going to be pleading guilty and reading a kind of confession, then it exploded, and we had people there that I've never seen before. I guess the general point I just want to make, without indicting any specific individuals, even though there are certain individuals that deserve to be called out, and I'll call them out when it is appropriate, but for right now, I just think the general point I wanted to drive home is there are four or five people who have been there every single day of the proceedings, regardless of whether they thought there was going to be quote-unquote breaking news.
Mm-hmm.
I've been one of those people. There's a woman who's an independent journalist. Her name is Alexa O'Brien. She's been doing transcripts of the proceedings because we do not have access to records until a couple days ago, but even that is questionable and unsatisfactory what they are doing. But we do not have a transcript of these proceedings to read after they conclude.
Mm-hmm.
There's a transcript of what Khalid Sheikh Mohammed said in court at the Guantanamo Kangaroo Court, but we don't have anything from the Manning proceeding.
And
so she's been doing a public service. There's his name's Adam Klasfeld at Courthouse News. And then there's been reporters from the wire services of the Associated Press, Agence France-Presse. And then, to her credit, Julie Tate of the Washington Post has been there pretty much every day for the last month. Maybe not in the beginning, but she's become a fixture of covering. And I just, you know, I mention those people because I'd like, if anybody is doing their own blogging or maybe they're reporting from afar and they can't make it to the court-martial, you should cite those individuals because they're the ones who really understand what's going on. Charlie Savage comes when there's going to be breaking news because Charlie Savage is a serious journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't want to waste his time. So there's always going to be breaking news. I can find something every single day at these proceedings that is worth headlining and presenting to readers, and I can make it interesting. Even if I'm sitting there and it sounds like something that the public would be falling asleep as they heard. And so I just want people to understand that this is the biggest military justice case in the history of the United States about the largest national security leaks that have ever occurred in the history of the United States. And the fact that this isn't something where you would find wall-to-wall coverage every day of the proceedings whenever the court is in session is really a travesty. There isn't anything else that they should be covering. There may be other things going on. I know sequester has occupied a lot of time for these reporters. John Brennan's confirmation was getting a lot of coverage from these national security reporters. But people need to be there and covering this because the fact remains is that the foreign press is way more interested in this story than the U.S. press.
Yeah.
And that should put everyone in the U.S. media to shame because there are people from France, Spain, I think there's been some people from Russia. I've seen Latin American reporters that have dropped in when they were able to make it. And these people come to see what's happening and write a story, and the U.S. press, who actually are in this country, do not cover it regularly.
And, Kevin, the first source I found for the information about a guy from SEAL Team 6 testifying is from The Telegraph, and the reporter is Raf Sanchez for that British newspaper. I couldn't find anything about that in the American media.
Yeah, that was the angle he took up. It was a good angle, and that's the other thing, is that some of these people, you know, like The Guardian has dropped in, and The Telegraph have dropped in, and what's fascinating about them, and then, you know, maybe like me and some of these alternative outlets that show up, is our headlines are never going to be the most generic. So lots of people had their headlines were Manning pleads guilty. Well, everything just kind of like runs together. I mean, tell me something about Manning pleading guilty. What exactly did he just do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I focused on the fact that he was going to the press. Rock Bear talking about the seal operator was the day before. But, you know, I think that the other thing is you have hive mind with the press of people just, you know, there's a lot that people can really get into, and it needs to happen. People need to get into it. But some of the stuff that's said in court is heard and then never revisited, unfortunately.
Well, Kevin, thank you for giving us your account today and for the work that you're doing at FireDogLake.com.
All right. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening and listening all the way through. Your comments are welcome. Humble host at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.